Hello and welcome to the Health Report with me, Norman Swan. This week, the Amen tool for doctors and nurses uncomfortable with the spiritual side of their patients. Using palliative care when you're not dying. New guidelines for Australian intensive care units on end-of-life care. And speaking of which, do you ever wonder whether doctors offer advice that they'd take themselves? Well, a fascinating study has asked doctors what they'd want at the end of their lives. Here's one of the researchers, Vijay Periyakoil, a palliative care physician and geriatrician at Stanford University in California, who thinks the issue of decisions around the end of life is one of the largest public health issues facing us.
I really think so. I think aging and the life care continuum of how older adults die is a huge issue, and I think it's something that we really need to pay attention to. The population is vulnerable. It doesn't matter who you are, when you're older and you're seriously ill, you have very little control. Therefore, it behooves us as a society to put policies in place, to put safeguards in place so that people don't get subjected to things that they would not want. I think that's absolutely critical.
And presumably you did this study because doctors, rightly or wrongly, are the focal point for a lot of these discussions, and therefore their attitudes are important.
Absolutely. Patients expect the doctors to initiate them, whereas we know for a fact that this is not something that doctors, A, are comfortable with, B, have the time for, usually.
And you were looking at the disparity between what doctors would recommend for their patients and what they would choose for themselves.
So the study has two parts. The first part of the study was looking to see if doctors' attitudes towards advance directives had changed after the passage of the Patient Self-Determination Act.
Tell me about this act.
About 23, 24 years ago, the United States government passed the Patient Self-Determination Act. Hospitals and staff had to be skilled at conducting advanced care planning conversations. And two, every patient who sets foot in a federal funded hospital, which is pretty much all of them, has the right to complete an advance directive. So our first part of our study was looking to find out, had doctors' attitudes changed after the passage of the law? Just 1 year before the law was passed, they did a survey of 790 physicians and specifically asked a 14-item questionnaire on their attitudes towards advance directives. What we did was we looked at the exact same questionnaire and we implemented that here at Stanford. We had 1,147 doctors we approached, and what we found was of the 14 items that we looked at, doctors' opinions had changed only related to three items. Doctors in 2013 did not feel that advance directives would influence the care of people who did not have an advance directive. It means that if patient A had an advance directive that says, please do not resuscitate me because I'm terminally ill, that would not influence the care of patient B who did not have an advance directive. Or to state it somewhat simplistically, advance directives are not contagious.
What else did you find?
The second attitude item was doctors expressed greater confidence if they were following patients' advance directives. And then on the other side of that coin is, I'm less likely to get sued.
And that was a concern 25 years ago, whatever it was.
Yeah, exactly. What was more surprising was overall, I would have expected in the last 23 years, because of all the educational efforts and the national and the international attention to patient congruent care, shared decision making, advance directives, that doctors in 2013, 2014 would be wildly optimistic about advance directives and extremely positive about it. But that's not what we found. That is part one of the study. And then part two was looking at what would doctors want for themselves if they were seriously ill. There is this widespread perception from patients that if your doctor were to say, I would not recommend fill in the blank, you know, I would not recommend experimental chemotherapy. I would not recommend that you opt for ventilation and support because it's unlikely to be beneficial. Patients may feel that the doctor is actually withholding important treatment options.
Tell me about the study.
We actually had young doctors complete a simulated advance directive for themselves. And what we found was 88.3% of the doctors wanted to be do not resuscitate if they were terminally ill.
And how did their attitude towards do not resuscitate compare to whether or not they were in favor of advance directives with their patients?
People who were less in favor of advance directives were more likely to opt for high-intensity treatment even in the face of serious or terminal illness, and also less in favor of organ donation.
But DNR, do not resuscitate, is a very different issue from somebody who is 93 with operable pancreatic cancer and the surgeon offers major surgery. So heroic surgery is one thing. Getting admitted to the intensive care unit, there's subtler versions of heroic treatment. What did the doctors say about that, which is different from DNR? And it's what the system offers patients, and it's where enormous sums of money are wasted and people and their families get what they don't want.
Your point is really well taken. The advanced directives as it's structured, which is the simulation that they did, specifically asks about what would you want if you were terminally ill. So that is exactly what we asked. What we did not ask for, which is what you're alluding to, is when the outcomes are still uncertain, but the prognosis may not be exactly too optimistic, then what would doctors choose? No, we did not ask that question.
So what did you conclude from the study?
Doctors, when they are seriously ill, when they have a terminal condition, prefer to die gently and peacefully. Are they any different from patients? Not at all, because the California Healthcare Foundation did a large survey and found that patients overwhelmingly also want to be at home, die gently and peacefully. And most importantly, patients don't want to be a burden on their families. And that happens a lot when you're providing ineffective high-intensity treatments to patients.
But here's the rub. If you have a life-limiting illness, you could actually be offered very expensive toxic care, which could make you feel really lousy for the extra few months of life, when the evidence is, for example, if you were referred to palliative care, you might actually even, the evidence from Australia is you might actually live longer and happier. And doctors are resisting this. And this is where an enormous amount of money and suffering occurs. Now, you're dealing with this every day of the week as a geriatrician. How do you get doctors to change? Because there is other research to suggest that they wouldn't choose this care for themselves. They wouldn't go to intensive care. They wouldn't have that extra course of chemo, and yet they're offering it to their patients.
I think that the solution is twofold. We look to doctors to lead medical care, but I think...
But that gets us into all sorts of trouble.
I think they need to be trained to be able to do it better. So I think this is where, back in the 60s, when we gave back birthing to the general public. Before that, it used to be medicalized for a while.
So people and their families, patients and their families, need to take control and tell the doctors what they want.
Exactly. We need to demedicalize death, and we need to be able to give the control back to the patients and families. If you just sit in silence, where you say you have a limited lifespan, sit and wait in compassion, patients will take some time, they absorb the shock, and then they'll come back and say, "Are you sure?" And then you have to say, "Yeah, I kind of am." And that then opens the right door to the next level of deeper, more honest conversation. It's almost like a phenotype of, "I don't like advanced directives."
And they're almost expressing their own fears and views.
Exactly. So it becomes more of personal death awareness, and it's very hard to deal with the fact that we all will die.
And did you assess their religiosity?
No, we did not. Because these are trainees, we were very careful not to ask too many personal identifiers in a way that would compromise their identification. So no, we did not. But your point is well taken.
And what about women versus men?
Women were a little bit more positively oriented towards advanced directives. And the other comparison we did is looking at ethnicity of the doctors. And we found that Caucasian doctors and African American doctors were equally positively disposed towards advanced directives. And right after them were Asian doctors. And after the Asian doctors were the Hispanic American doctors. Having said that, that's just stratification within the ethnic groups. Overall, all doctors were positively oriented towards advanced directives, and 88.3 wanted to be, you know, die gently without high-intensity treatments.
That's for themselves. Vijay Periyakoil is a palliative care physician and geriatrician at Stanford University in California. And you're listening to The Health Report here on RN with me, Norman Swan. There's still a lot of fear around the phrase palliative care. We link it to imminent death. An experiment in changing the way care is given to people with cancer has shown that this link to death need not be so, although the fear is still there, at least amongst doctors. Richard Riedel is a medical oncologist, a cancer specialist at Duke University Medical Center in North Carolina.
In looking at our cancer patients that were admitted to the hospital, it was clear that they had a significant symptom burden. And they were challenged by the sense that, or we were challenged by the sense that patients were often readmitted for repeat symptoms that were inadequately controlled.
Such as?
Pain, nausea, vomiting, symptoms related to treatment or complications of their disease itself.
Across the board?
Across the board, yes.
I mean, that's a common problem internationally.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I think certainly for patients with advanced cancer, and I would say 3/4 of the patients that are admitted to our inpatient ward have advanced cancer. What comes with them is a significant symptom burden.
So what did you try to do to solve the problem?
We partnered with our palliative care colleagues who previously played a very limited role on our inpatient oncology service. And we partnered with them to bring their skill and expertise to our inpatient ward on a daily basis. And that's in stark contrast to where we were before, where all patients were managed by one medical oncologist. We created a scenario where we now not only had a medical oncologist, but a palliative care trained hospitalist who, in conjunction with a medical oncologist, would help care for the patients on the inpatient ward.
Because it's one of the misconceptions about palliative care is that people think that palliative care is for the last 2 weeks of life and it's about morphine, when in fact what palliative care physicians are really good at is improving the quality of life of people with cancer and indeed other conditions, sometimes years away from the time that you might die.
I think that's very true. And I think the perception that many patients have is in part due to a misappropriate or inappropriate effort on the part of physicians not to get hospice involved early enough. There's an increasing trend in recognition now that early intervention with palliative care has the potential to impact patients in a good way.
Well, I think Australian research has shown that you extend survival.
Australian data, there's also data from Jennifer Temel in a study published in Lung Cancer showing that early intervention with palliative care improves survival as well.
Did you have any resistance, before we get to the results, did you get any resistance from patients saying, my God, you think I'm going to die in a month's time if you're getting me to see a palliative care physician?
We had a lot of concern about what the perception would be, not only on behalf of the patients, but also on behalf of our medical oncology colleagues. We don't make an active effort to introduce the provider as a palliative care physician. We will introduce them the same way I introduce myself. I'm a partner with your outpatient oncologist. And the title itself is less important.
So to make it tangible for the person listening to us, give me a typical patient journey into your ward, the way it was and the way it is now, and how it's different.
So the way it was prior to 2007 is that all patients admitted to the inpatient ward were under the supervision of a medical oncologist. And it was the medical oncologist's job to see each patient daily, make treatment plans, and follow them through the duration of their hospitalization. And what we do currently is all patients who are admitted to the inpatient ward are discussed in sort of a multidisciplinary rounds with both the medical oncologist and palliative care physician. And then there's a determination made as to who the attending of record would be, who would best serve the needs of the patient.
Well, who's the doctor who's going to take charge?
That's correct. And so in some cases, it's the medical oncologist, and in other cases, it's the palliative care physician. But importantly, we have touchdown points throughout the day where the team will meet as a whole with both attendings being present.
And when you say attendings, that's the American for what we would call consultants.
Yes. And there would be a discussion regarding the needs of the patient. And it allows for both formal and informal consultation between the medical oncologist and the palliative care physician in terms of how to best move the care of the patient forward. Now, not every patient will necessarily see the palliative care provider, but the palliative care provider is present and can provide input for all patients.
So you might advise the medical oncologist, this is what you need to do about their constipation, this is what you need to do about their pain or their nausea or their depression.
That's correct.
What were the results?
What we were able to show is that in a cohort that was studied during a time period after approximately 1 year of implementation, we were able to show that the presence of the palliative care group in conjunction with the medical oncologist decreased the length of stay for patients by a little less than half a day. We were also able to show that our 7-day and 30-day readmission rates were significantly decreased. And we were able to show that ICU transfers were decreased, although that was not statistically significant. And we were able to
show. In other words, you kind of interrupted a pathway to serious illness.
We'd like to think so. And lastly, we were able to show that hospice referrals increased in the post-intervention period. Again, not statistically significant, the numbers were small, but I think certainly showing a trend towards benefit.
And what did people with cancer think about it?
Again, I think the patient themselves, I don't think, are fully aware of the fact that we have this process ongoing. They have, you know, they see a single provider who comes to them daily, who cares for them and works with their outpatient provider, but I don't think they have a full understanding of the logistics involved.
So they don't know they'll be looking after by a palliative care physician?
I think many of them don't.
To the Australian ears, that sounds like a lack of transparency in terms of the patient involvement in their own care.
I think it can be perceived like that, and certainly we're not in a position to hide that from patients, and certainly if they ask, we're open and honest about the issue. I think the reality is most patients recognize that they have a significant symptom burden, and it doesn't matter who's taking care of them. If their symptoms are getting better, I think they're pleased.
Now, let's talk about the cancer specialists, because one of the problems, at least in Australia, is, but I suspect it's true in the United States, is that the biggest barrier to palliative care referrals are the cancer specialists themselves, who might be on their fourth round of chemo, and they've deluded themselves into thinking they're still giving curative care, when in fact, as a cancer specialist, you've been delivering palliative care for 3 years, and just not admitting it to yourself.
I think that's fair. You know, I think for too long we've been so focused, and generally speaking, I think medical oncologists are so focused on attacking the cancer. I think there's, again, increasing recognition that we can do better, and that by having our palliative care colleagues as an additional layer of support early on in the disease course, we have the potential to provide more meaningful impact.
So is the model spreading?
I think there's certainly been a lot of interest nationally about the model, and we actually have had some interest internationally as well, just to make sure that people for individuals to gain a better understanding of how we actually do it.
Now, a lot of chemotherapy now is done on an outpatient basis, so people don't get admitted to hospital, and if they get their symptoms, they're often readmitted for the day just to a day clinic to get their symptoms sorted out, but not with a palliative care physician attached. What are you doing in your outpatient clinics when people don't get admitted but they have a symptom burden? Are you going to integrate palliative care into a standard chemotherapy clinic?
We've actually done that already. So we have an outpatient palliative care clinic that provides coverage about 5 days a week, and it started just a couple of years ago and has quickly expanded. Again, we have the layer of support on the inpatient realm, and we've complemented that with the outpatient clinic as well.
Richard Riedel is a medical oncologist at Duke University Medical Center in North Carolina. One of the things often missing in modern medicine is attention to or respect for the spiritual life of patients and families, which includes miraculous thinking. And that's why Rhonda Cooper developed the Amen Tool. Reverend Cooper is the Kimmel Cancer Center chaplain at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore.
The Amen Tool was developed in part because I observed the team, not only the physicians but the nurses, being a bit stymied, the doctor says to the family of a very ill patient. We've done everything we can, and we fear that your loved one will not survive his illness. The family would listen very respectfully, but after the physician finished, they would say, "Thanks, doctor, but we believe God will heal our husband by miracle."
Even if they didn't say that, a lot of people still hope that something miraculous would occur, even if they don't have any particular religious belief.
Of course. However, when they say it, the team would often respond in an argumentative way or trying to convince them that was not going to happen, which is outside their scope of practice, to talk theologically. Or they would say something that might sound snide. So how do you help them join with the patient and see this kind of comment as an invitation to continue the conversation, not to stop it? For instance, if someone says, "Well, doc, I'm hoping for a miracle," a way to join them could be, "I hear that you are hopeful, and we always have hope too." Instead of saying, "Well, you can hope that all you want, but it's not going to happen," which I actually heard that once. Respecting, reflecting back what they've said, and to, above all, assure them that no matter what the future brings, that we on the team will accompany you on that journey.
Which is what palliative care physicians and nurses do all the time.
Yes.
Just it doesn't happen on the regular ward.
Right.
Dealing with the spiritual world, regardless of whether you have a religious belief or not.
Exactly. And also the concept of non-abandonment. Sometimes a committed medical team, even though they may not say it this way, if they have suggested wonderful treatment and the patient's been compliant and everything has been done, yet that patient's path leads them to death instead of cure, when a caregiver is really invested in that, they may have a tendency to take that personally and disengage.
How does it work?
So the protocol, which is entitled AMEN or AMEN, the A is for affirm the patient or the family's belief. Affirm does not mean agree with it. When the patient says, well, I'm praying or I'm believing there will be a miracle, a simple response would be, I'm hopeful too. And then the second part would be the M, or the meet the patient where they are. Then thirdly, you can then educate from your own role.
This is the E of the AMEN.
This is the E, yes. The provider's role is to give the patient or the family their best medical opinion. And so they might move to, I'm hopeful too, and I would like to share some information that I think will be helpful. But we say, throw out the word but, which is really hard to do, actually. Throw that out and say, I'm hopeful, and let me also share some information that may be helpful to you from my perspective. And finally is the no matter what, or the idea of non-abandonment. That is, we're committed to your loved one's care, or as the patient, we're committed to your care, and we are going to be with you every step of the way. And we don't say, I am going to be with you the whole way, because frankly, that's probably not true.
But the team will be.
The team, your caregivers, we will be with you. And so this allows both the provider and the patient or family to stay in their role with integrity.
No matter what, Reverend Rhonda Cooper is a chaplain at Johns Hopkins University Medical Center in Baltimore. The intensive care unit is where a lot of people die in hospitals, often sent to the ICU inappropriately, which puts a huge burden on intensive care unit staff assisting families make very difficult decisions, which is one reason why the Australian and New Zealand Intensive Care Society has released some guidance for ICU doctors and nurses. Associate Professor Bill Sylvester chaired the group which put this statement together with the aim of reducing the number of people who die inappropriately in intensive care.
People who are dying inappropriately in intensive care, people whose life is being prolonged when there's no realistic chance of survival or returning to a quality of life that that patient would see as acceptable.
That implies that the referral patterns from your colleagues in hospitals, your surgeons and physicians and others who are sending patients to our ICU, are on occasion doing it inappropriately.
That's correct. We certainly do get quite a few referrals to an intensive care unit where the referral has been made either because the patient or the family or indeed the doctors are referring the patient when in fact it would be best if they stay in the ward and be kept comfortable and allowed to die with their family and loved ones at the bedside.
Does this statement deal with that problem?
This statement gives guidance to intensive care staff about how to assess the sort of patient who really isn't going to benefit by coming into intensive care. And it gives practical guidance about how to deal with those medical teams out in the wards who are making that referral. And indeed to assist us in giving guidance to those doctors about how to go and talk to the patient and the family and saying it's really not in your family member's best interest to come into the intensive care unit. Often we find that the referral's been made because the doctor out there is struggling to have the conversation with the patient or the family, or they say they don't want to play God, or they are struggling to come to terms with the fact that their patient's not going to survive.
So give me a typical story and the way the guidance in this document would help.
A typical patient may be an elderly person who has got cancer, who has developed an infection, and the cancer doctors or the general physicians or the surgeons are requesting that this patient comes into the ICU to receive full life support therapy, including going onto a ventilator. They may require dialysis and require intravenous antibiotics. When it's clear to the intensive care team that although we could go through that process, this patient's chances of survival are very low, or indeed if they survived intensive care, they'd really just be then going back to the ward to die and would never get home back to a quality of life that they would see as acceptable.
So what does this document advise intensive care staff to do in this situation?
It guides doctors to sit down, look at what is possible, and then go and talk to the patient and the family and say, the following are things we can do, but if you're asking for a life-prolonging treatment that we don't believe will help, this is why it won't help. And often at that point, if the family is struggling with it or the doctors are struggling with it, we guide them to think through what is it we're really trying to achieve here? What do we know about the goals and values and preferences of this patient, whether they've been expressed verbally or through an advanced care plan? And how does what we're offering here fit with those preferences? And then having established that, we then are able to get those doctors and the family to think about not what they want, but what they believe the patient would want under those circumstances.
And if the person themselves, that person is not conscious, this is where angels fear to tread.
Yep. Not only does the doctor often feel burdened by making that decision, but the families will also feel burdened. So that's where we as doctors, particularly the intensive care specialists, when we're asked to see these patients, have to indicate, look, we're not asking you, the family, for example, to make this decision. We're making the decision on what's clinically appropriate, what can it be of benefit, and we're really asking you to just guide us about what the patient would have said under these circumstances if we're able to talk to them.
There's sort of mutually conflicting themes here. You talk about the traditional three things in medical ethics: beneficence, which is acting to benefit the patient, non-maleficence, which is avoid harming the patient, and autonomy. The family would say, well, we're acting to benefit our father or mother, want to avoid harming our father or mother, but in fact, if we don't send our father or mother to ICU, he or she might die in the next 2 or 3 days. You've got benefit and harm in conflict here.
That's often the perception, but in fact, if we are truly looking at what the likely outcome is and whether that person's going to be returned to a quality of life that they would be happy with, then in fact, both the beneficence, doing good, and the non-maleficence, not doing harm, are indeed aligned. The difficulty is that they haven't had a chance to think about it. I don't remember the last time that when I've sat down with a patient's family, they haven't then understood that that's where the decision-making needs to rest.
And what about autonomy? So somebody's conscious and they're in the ward and being transferred to ICU and you really don't think it's going to be of benefit to them. And the person makes an autonomous decision saying, I want it, pull out all the stops, ventilate me, do everything, give me the most expensive antibiotics. I don't care. This is my one chance. What's the conversation then?
Well, the conversation is about the fact that under common law, both here in Australia and in New Zealand, it's the doctor's responsibility to work out what's in the patient's best interests.
But hold on a second. I mean, you've just written this whole big document for intensive care physicians and staff, and autonomy sits there right up there, and somebody says, I want it, give me everything, and you're saying, well, in the end, stuff autonomy, we'll do whatever we like as doctors.
But our responsibility, Norman, as doctors, is not to do things to patients that would harm them.
So and autonomy, from your point of view, is autonomy to say, no, I don't want to go to ICU. But if it's autonomy saying, I do want to go to ICU, they've crossed a line where autonomy can be ruptured.
It doesn't come down to giving the ultimate responsibility just to the patient or to the doctor, but taking a shared decision-making approach. And it's interesting that there's never been a case in Australia where a doctor's been successfully sued for withholding a treatment if they didn't believe it was in the patient's best interest. But there have been many cases where doctors have been successfully sued because they went ahead with a treatment that they didn't believe was in the patient's best interest, but the patient demanded it. And when it's ended up in court, the patient's lawyer said, so doctor, you were prepared to go ahead and do something to my client when you knew it was not going to help them, and they've now suffered consequences. So in fact, the law supports this ethical basis that we shouldn't do something we know is not in their best interest.
Associate Professor Bill Sylvester. And we'll have a link to that guidance from the Australian and New Zealand Intensive Care Society on the Health Report's website, because the Health Report is what you've been listening to. I'll see you next week.